So this morning begins what Christians around the world refer to as Holy Week. The week the events leading up to the death and resurrection of Jesus took place, otherwise known as Christ's Passion. So if you hear the term Passion, the Passion of the Christ, this is in reference to the Passion narratives in Scripture, this final week. And this typically begins, it's seen as beginning, Holy Week, in the gospel accounts on Palm Sunday, on which Jesus rides into Jerusalem. The crowds wave these palm branches, shout Hosanna. This is a text we looked at together a few weeks ago, actually. And so on this particular Palm Sunday, as we continue through John's account, rather than finding ourselves reading of Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, we read instead of the events here in John 18 that lead to his crucifixion in chapter 19. And in doing so, what we actually see is the very basis for our remembrance of Holy Week. We see the reason Palm Sunday took place. We see the reason Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem the way that he does. Because there's a question. And it's a question that the text anticipates. You know, it's a question of why. And this question of why is a question that John is uniquely interested in addressing. So we could phrase it this way. Why do hundreds of millions of Christians around the globe with us this morning stop to reflect and remember Palm Sunday? You know, why do millions of Christians around the globe prepare to remember together Good Friday with us this coming Friday, and then correspondingly Easter Sunday? And so we'll talk more about that question on Friday night as it relates to the cross. But this morning we're going to see it answered in three sections of the text. Like, why does the church say these events are what's central to the Christian faith, to Christian doctrine? These events are right at the heart of Christianity. Why? Well, we see it answered in three sections of the text broadly, and really we're going to see it in three ironies, three uses of irony in the text that John uses to draw this out. And irony is something that's going to be important for us to understand because John is well known for his use of irony. Okay, so this is something that John's going to use more and more. He's already used irony a lot, okay? It's going to happen more and more as we get into chapter 19 on Good Friday, the resurrection, and even into chapter 21. And so we have to have a working understanding of this rhetorical device known as irony. And I would say, it's ironic. We use the word irony a lot in our culture. You know, we throw it around a lot, but we don't always know what it means. And I blame Alanis Morissette, who wrote in my junior high school days a song, you know, Isn't It Ironic? And she gave us a bunch of examples of this, you know, rain on your wedding day, good advice that you just didn't take, free ride, you already paid. And as it's been pointed out before, you know, it's like, those really aren't irony. It's like, if she would have called the song Unfortunate, that would have been correct. So these are unfortunate events. Irony is not unfortunate. So let me define it for us. Here's Oxford English Dictionary. Irony is the expression of one's meaning. So there's a statement that you want to make. There's a meaning that you want to get across. How do you get across that meaning? Well, it's the expression of one's meaning by using language that normally signifies or amplifies the opposite. You know, you want to get across a meaning, but you're attempting to get across the meaning by using language describing something in a way that typically signifies or amplifies the opposite of what you mean, okay? And this is done for emphatic effect, to emphasize something, or it's done for the purposes of humor, okay? But we see that in the text. You're going to see, I think, better examples than Alanis gave us here in John 18. And together, here's what we'll see. Let me just really quickly run through the outline at the front end. We're going to see, first in the ironies, we're going to see the problem. The problem that's at the center of Palm Sunday, why Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. Another way of saying this is we're going to see the why of the gospel. We're going to also see the purpose at the center of Palm Sunday, like the what, why Jesus set his face to Jerusalem. What it is during Holy Week that Jesus was setting out to accomplish. You know, if that's the problem, What was Jesus purposing to do about it? And we can't talk about those things without the person, all right, the who of the gospel, the person at the center of Palm Sunday. So the problem, the purpose, the person, or if you like, the why, the what, the who of Holy Week. So let's begin with the problem. Look with me at verses 28 to 31. Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusations do you bring against this man?" They answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." Pilate said to them, "Take him for yourselves. Judge him by your own law." The Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." So here we have the problem at the heart of Palm Sunday, the problem at the center of Passion Week in particular, Good Friday into Easter. Here we see the motivation behind the incarnation, okay? And we see it in a few different ways, because first, notice the scene here. The scene is quite ironic. And in order to understand that, we need to get some of the context, so let's just back up really quickly. After the opening gambit, do you remember the opening move from Annas last week to try to get information from Jesus that would be damning in front of the Sanhedrin, which fell completely flat? And if you want to hear more about that, go back and listen. Jesus was then bound, sent off to Caiaphas, where the illegal trial continued, and that's specifically detailed in other gospel accounts. John doesn't go into it here, so I encourage you, go and read Matthew, the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as they describe this trial before the Sanhedrin, where Caiaphas famously and really theatrically, it's a lot of theater, tears his robe and accuses Jesus of blasphemy. The rest of the Sanhedrin gather together saying he deserves death. So for our purposes, we see a verdict has been rendered, and John just assumes the verdict in his telling of these gospel accounts. He just assumes that it's happened, and instead he focuses all of his interaction here on Pilate. And this is by far, across all four gospel accounts, the longest interaction with Pilate. Okay, and it's important. This is very clearly where John wants to set his attention, purposefully. Right, we'll see again, we'll be reminded again when we get to that text, and John says, you know, "Hey, there are many different things that I could have written, but these are included so that you might believe," right? So John has a unique "so that you might believe" emphasis on what he leaves out, that Jesus before the Sanhedrin, and what he decides to focus more on, which is Jesus' time here in front of Pilate. So who's Pilate? He's the Roman governor over Judea during this time, and we know from extra-biblical historical sources, so writings outside of the Bible, that Pilate was appointed prefect of Judea around 26 AD, and he was in charge of Roman interests in this region, specifically headquartered in Jerusalem, until about AD 37, where he loses his post. The events here are, I would guess, AD 33, so coming to the end of Pilate's time in this office, but still well square within it. And what you have to understand about Pilate from the outset, and again, this is not something that we know just from our time reading John and the other gospel accounts. This is something that's actually well attested in literature outside of the scriptures. He's a man who's plagued with the concerns of most politicians, you know? And as we learn about him, we learn that there's nothing really new under the sun related to politics, right? Because he has his own interests front and center here. He's leading out of a self-interest in his own power and his own status. And so if he makes a decision, in other words, that results in Jewish uprising, again, during a time where messianic fervor was at a fever pitch, right? We've talked about this a lot. He will undoubtedly lose his post at the very least. Some form of punishment could be likely as well. So from Pilate's perspective, there's an awful lot to lose if the results of his actions lead to a Jewish uprising, right? And I think from Pilate's perspective, but certainly we see in the text, this really, in a sense, binds his hands from actually examining what's happening. You know, he doesn't in any sense allow his conscience to be a guide, even though he clearly expresses what he thinks is happening, and then he decides against it. So it's a lot like politics today. There's a self-interest involved in which many politicians, though not all, but many politicians routinely act out of line with their conscience, perhaps endorsing legislation they believe to be bad for the country or endorsing a candidate for office that they believe to be bad for the country out of a fear that if they stand on principle, they could alienate their base and cause them to lose their positions. There's a self-interest. But Pilate is not the only self-interested leader in the narrative. In fact, this is the whole setting. The whole setting is self-interested leaders, you know? Because look at how the interaction starts, verse 28. The religious leaders won't enter the headquarters, you know? So you have Pilate on the inside, and the religious leaders won't come in. And we start to see the irony here, this first use of irony, because the reason they won't enter is that the Mishnah, and we need to understand, this is Jewish oral tradition, okay? This is not the law, but rather how the law had been interpreted and what had been added to the Old Testament scripture. This had interpreted the law to mean that any Jew who entered the dwelling place of a Gentile needed to become ceremonially clean before eating a feast, right? Entering the dwelling place of a Gentile made one ceremonially unclean. Therefore, there was a cleansing ritual you would have to participate in order to enter the feast. But apparently, there's not enough time for them to enter in, go through this cleansing ritual, and still eat the Passover. So in order to avoid that, the problem that they perceive here that some of these laws lay out, they decide not to eat. We need to remember, the way the Jewish religious leaders led the people throughout their history was that whenever they worried about God's people becoming lax around a particular law, you know, or a particular sin area, they would solve that problem of like supposed laxity by adding like 40 new laws. And, you know, we saw that as it relates to the Sabbath in John already, right? So there's all these laws that have been made on top of law in order to keep God's people from being too overly lax as it relates to the Sabbath, and Jesus confronts that, and we see it here as well. We see an example of it playing out. We also see here that example of the problem at the center of the passion. You know, this why of the gospel, because here we see the reliance of the religious leaders and the people through the rest of this account on the works of the law to reconcile them to God, because there isn't really a need for reconciliation if they're able to be holy enough. If they're able to, by the works of their own abilities, their own merits, measure up to God's standard. And so what does that mean the Messiah is there to do? Well, to rescue them from the Roman Empire. And so we also see the irony here. So here's where we see kind of John's first use of irony. The religious leaders, they're outside, fastidiously obeying the oral tradition about ceremonial law prior to Passover. You know, not even the scriptures and what they have to say about ceremonial law, but the oral tradition, you know, and some of these additional laws. They're very concerned about this. Meanwhile, simultaneously, they're manipulating the judicial system, holding an illegal trial to put an innocent man to death in order to keep their power. And Jesus is inside doing what he's doing precisely because, you know, here they are outside, worried about their outward holiness, that they've somehow become ceremonially unclean, but their hearts are dark, and you can see it in the actions of their heart. Jesus knows this. That's why he's inside. That's why he's doing what he's doing. It reminds us of the irony in the text last week, in which Peter is outside, refusing to deal with the consequences of his own actions, while Jesus is inside with Annas, in order to deal with the consequences of Peter's actions. This is the problem on full display. The religious leaders are knowingly sending an innocent man to his death out of self-interest. If we remember the narratives up to this point, right, they've acknowledged the only way that, you know, the blind are seeing and in this case, the dead are being raised with Lazarus and these things, is if God is involved. None of them deny this. None of them attempt to argue that God is the one who's involved. And nevertheless, they conclude he needs to die. Why? Because of self-interest. It's their own power. They want to end around God in order to essentially make themselves God. It's exactly what we see at the garden. But also look what happens. So Pilate's willing to acquiesce to their religious observations, which wouldn't have been abnormal. I think some people read that and they think, well, this is evidence of John kind of making this up, inventing this, because why would the Roman prefect bend the will to the Jewish leaders? No, this was common, especially, you know, we have to remember, this was Roman occupation in Jerusalem, okay, and especially when there's high feasts like Passover, Rome wanted to avoid conflict where possible, so it would have been easy enough for him to meet them on the stoop. But because of the insistence on the part of religious leaders to hold the law, you know, and it reminds us of Jesus' words about the Pharisees when he talks about them being whitewashed tombs who are interested in like tithing out various spices, but inward their hearts are darkened, you know. We see that happening here. Like they're willing to go above and beyond to stay out of a Gentile's headquarters manipulating the law. But because of that insistence, Pilate now has to go, and John, I think, shows us this historical event for this reason, right? Pilate has to go back and forth now, okay? And what he's essentially doing is he's going back and forth between those who want Jesus crucified on the front stoop, you know, on his front entryway, representing the world order, the created world order in act of rebellion against its creator on the one hand. So he's going back and forth between the created world order in act of rebellion and the creator himself. He goes to them. He hears the charges. He goes to Jesus. He talks to Jesus. He goes back again. And in doing so, he sets up a dichotomy in the text that I think is very intentional, you know, between the world and Jesus, and essentially holds out, as John does, this black and white, like, with whom will you identify? With whom will Pilate identify ultimately? So, you know, Paul Duke has this wonderful book, Irony in the Fourth Gospel. And he writes this, he says, in Pilate's shuttling back and forth, the author portrays the human predicament in which one must choose between Jesus and the world. There's a problem that's on full display. There is a human predicament, and that is the created world order, an act of rebellion against its creator. And Pilate's back and forth just, it amplifies that dichotomy, that difference between the two, and our need to do something about it. So the problem at the center of the passion on full display, it's our sin, it's our rebellion, it's our self-interest at the center of our own lives. And that gets produced, prodded along further with Pilate's question, what charges do you bring against this man? You know, because like when Pilate asks this question, one of the things you can see in the narrative is that the Jewish people are surprised. Like the religious leaders, they're surprised because he's essentially formally opening back up the proceedings. You know, what charges do you have? And this is not what they expect. You know, this is kind of a shock. Their expectation here is kind of a rubber stamp. Pilate's going to simply confirm their judgment and order the death sentence by crucifixion, but instead, he wants to hear evidence, you know? He wants to hear charges. He wants to do some examination before he comes to a conclusion. And we see how flustered they are by their response, which seems a little bit more aggressive than we might expect. It's almost a little bit surprising. Like, how could they talk to the Roman prefect this way? But I think they use this language because they're caught off guard. If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you, you know? It's like a trust us, you know, almost. But so there's eagerness to argue, quickness to push back. But I think the line of reasoning is probably something like, well, hey, Pilate agreed to send a detachment of Roman soldiers with us to arrest Jesus. So he must think that Jesus is a threat if he's going to commit forces to bringing him in. So it's only a matter of time now before he sends him to his death. And yet that's not what they hear, you know, so they get upset. Pilate's unimpressed by their aggressive tone, you know. And he says, I think unsympathetically and with a tone that might suggest some disinterest to kind of prod them back, fine. Take him yourselves. Judge him by your own law then. You can almost imagine him starting to close the door. Whoa, 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 wait, wait, wait. Right. Because they respond, we're not able to put him to death. You know, Pilate knows full well they can't do that. They can't take him themselves and judge him and still get what they want out of the deal, which we'll talk about in a bit. Pilate knows that they need him to accomplish their purpose, but he's unwilling to show himself as some kind of weak puppet of the religious leaders. So here's what you have. And this is kind of moving us into our second use of irony, because you have the Jewish religious leaders. What do they want? Control over the situation. Pretty clearly, you know, they want to be in control. They're driven by their own self-interest, totally, right? Then you have Pilate. What does he want? He wants to be in control of the situation. He needs to be, you know, for his own livelihood, for his own position. You know, and same with the religious authorities. They see it that way, their own positions of power. So driven by his own self-interest, he wants to be in control. This is the why of the gospel. This is the problem at the heart of the passion, the problem that Jesus came to deal with, our rebellion against him, driven by our own self-interests, that always seeks to end around God, you know, trying to gain control of my life, trying to gain wisdom apart from him, life apart from him. But again, John wants the reader to see, so here's the second piece of irony, that Jewish religious leaders want control, Pilate wants control. Neither one of them are in control, right? So this is where we move from the problem to the purpose, right? The purpose, the what of the gospel. So if that's the problem, what did Jesus set about to do about it? What did he set out to do about it? Okay, look at verse 32. This was to fulfill the word Jesus had spoken, right? So like, they're both wrestling for control. And then the first thing that John says is this was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken. Who's in control, you know? To show by what kind of death he was going to die, and that's a reference to the cross, and we'll come back to that in a little bit, but by what kind of death he was going to die, this is John's shorthand for the cross, and that's going to be important in a minute. So whatever power struggle we read here, and it is a struggle, to a certain extent, you know, like neither party here holds all the cards. Pilate holds more in the authority department. If he wanted to, he could wreak an awful lot of havoc on these religious leaders, although it wouldn't come without consequence to him. And being a politician, he's, right? So he knows that they have him to a certain extent over a barrel. At the same time, the religious leaders know that they need him. So there is a power struggle, but it's a struggle between two people who don't have any power in this situation, right? Like, there's some irony. John says it's ultimately the hand of God moving these various pieces into place. He's certainly using their stubborn hearts, their weak-willed responses, their self-centeredness on both sides to achieve his ultimate purpose, which is for him to come and die. So this phrase, by what kind of death he was going to die, ultimately refers to a cross. You know, it refers to a cross. And, you know, we need to understand, and we're going to see it in a second. Here Jesus makes a reference. It's the only time in the entirety of John's account that directly mentions Jesus' birth. You know, like the incarnation in that sense, his birth. Like John talks about it, the word becoming flesh, that's a mention of his birth. But here you have the only time when his birth is mentioned in terms of that kind of a word, the birth of Jesus. And when is it mentioned? In the exact same context as the cross, right before the cross. In other words, is it possible that if Jesus was to be handed over to the Jewish people, you know, that they might seek to stone him? Well, not only was that possible, but I think Pilate, almost to a certain extent, is kind of daring them. And as a matter of fact, very, very unlikely that the Romans would have cared at all. So the religious leaders stoned people in the first century. The Romans didn't care ultimately. But there's a problem here. They likely don't want to be seen as the direct cause of Jesus' death out of fear that they'll lose the support of the people. Knowing how popular Jesus had become, we've already heard that struggle throughout John's account. You know, they know he needs to die for them to retain power. But they don't want to lose the support of the people. They're worried about a mob rising up against them. So if the Romans step in and find fault in Jesus' words that render their own verdict of death on the cross, it kind of has a positive twofold effect. It's a win-win for the Jewish authorities because it allows them, first of all, a kind of plausible deniability of saying like, whoa, we're not the ones who decide these things. You know, like Jesus was very, you guys know, he's very loud about the declarations he made. It fell on the Roman ears and we can't risk all-out war with the Romans. So of course we handed them over, but this is their declaration. It's not ours. And also, so it allowed them plausible deniability, but it also secondly allowed the people to see from their perspective the gruesome death on a cross, the very public death that results from making these kinds of claims. Allows them to see from their vantage point also, really, this is your Messiah? What does Deuteronomy tell us? What does the law tell us? It says, anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. So this couldn't be the Messiah. He's under the curse of God. It's a public demonstration of his cursedness, not his blessedness, from their perspective. But what they couldn't understand is the purpose, the what of the gospel, the purpose of these events. They couldn't understand that Jesus went to the cross, actually, for that very reason. For that very reason. To bear the curse of the people, that on the basis of their merits, they should have been hung on a tree under the curse of God. That on the basis of how we have all lived, we should have been hung on the tree bearing the curse of God, bearing his wrath against sin. But Jesus went there on behalf of the people, despite himself not being guilty of the curse. And despite all of humanity being guilty, he goes to the cross. This is the what of the gospel. By what kind of death he was to die, it's a substitutionary death. It's death on a tree. It's death on a cross. It's death that's receiving God's curse, not because he deserved it, but actually because he's the only one who could come and save humanity from it because he didn't, right? This is the purpose of God becoming flesh and dwelling among us. It's the purpose of the incarnation. It's the purpose of Palm Sunday. Jesus setting his face toward Jerusalem. It's the purpose of the Passion Week, preparing his disciples for what was to come on Good Friday. It's the purpose of what we'll read Friday night together, and I invite you to come as we have readings throughout chapter 19, progressively as the evening unfolds, and we take a section of 19 to reflect upon in preaching and to sing together on Friday night. To worship, to hear, to reflect. It's the what of the gospel, Jesus bearing the cross on our behalf. But that's where we move now, even further into the center, because we can't have a discussion about the what of the gospel, the purpose, until we finally drill down into the person. This is the who of the gospel, starting in verse 33. So Pilate entered his headquarters again, and called Jesus and said to him, so again, the back and forth, right? Said to him, are you the king of the Jews? And so let's stop there for a minute. This section, the who of the gospel, will take us to the very end of this chapter. But in Pilate's question, we see the charges that the religious leaders eventually told Pilate. Well, he claims to be king of the Jews. All right. And yeah, as far as the religious leaders are concerned, this is a theological issue that they're taking up with him, because if he is who he claims to be, then they lose their power. They lose their authority, especially since he seems to be so constantly bucking their power and authority, you know. So their particular argument against him is theological, but Pilate doesn't care about Jewish theology. Right? He doesn't care about their positions either, you know, whether Caiaphas is the high priest or he gets overthrown by some other high priest, so long as they're going to be subservient to Rome, that's all that Pilate cares about. So why would they draw this charge to his attention? Well, because they know that if Jesus claimed to be king of the Jews, it's not just theological, it's also political. Caesar's considered the only king to whom everyone must show ultimate allegiance in this region. So it could create some problems for Pilate. Pilate was on the brink of losing his position, couldn't afford an uprising like we've talked about. This is exactly what a self-proclaimed king at this point in time in history could have generated at the time. It's exactly what he's been worried about. But for Jesus, there needs to be a determination like of what Pilate's really asking. So before Jesus can answer the question, he needs more information from Pilate. So he says in verse 34, Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say this about me?" Like, does this emerge, Pilate, from your understanding of what you've heard me say and your own curiosity here? Or is it simply repeating back to me what my accusers have said in kind of an indifferent kind of way? And the reason this is important is that if Pilate's own understanding and curiosity about Jesus is where this question emerges from, then Jesus can, like he has with so many in John's account, you know, the woman at the well, Nicodemus, the disciples, even just in the previous chapters as he's prepared them for the hours to come, he can graciously and patiently help him to see more and help Pilate to be prepared for the hours to come to see the events of the cross in a new kind of light. But if it's just repeating the charges of the men who are at the front entrance, Jesus really can't respond with a yes or a no. Like, yes, I am king of the Jews, or no, not like what you're saying. You know, like he can't respond to this question without major clarification because of how Pilate's going to be thinking about kingship, you know, as this political reality. So another quick note here is that Jesus again demonstrates, I just want you to notice who's in control. We've seen it, we keep noting it all along, so let's come back to it. Isn't Jesus the one who's supposed to be interrogated? You know, I feel like he keeps doing this. Last week with Annas and this week with Pilate, with the Roman governor. Jesus is the one who's supposed to be the one who's being interrogated, and yet now what's he doing? He's questioning Pilate in order to determine how he's going to proceed. As many of the commentators note on this point, he's not a prisoner, he's the judge, right? But he's a judge who's preparing himself to bear the punishment of the guilty defendant so that the guilty defendant can have freedom. You know, like that's what's happening in the text. That's the best way of describing these events. Verse 35, Pilate answered. You know, and you can see he doesn't like becoming the person who's being questioned. Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done? So we see, you know, I think the first part is kind of sarcastic and in the same way trying to express a form of indifference, like, why are you questioning me? Not only is he just repeating back the words that Jesus' accuser spoke to him about the charges, but he's giving off the appearance here that he doesn't care what the answer is. Like, he's not a Jew, he's saying, so why should he have any opinion about the king of the Jews? That's not his concern from his perspective, but we do see here also, like, in his response, there's some irony. He's not entirely buying the charges either. You know, like, you start to see Pilate seeing through some of this because he says at the tail end, he's like, you're a nation, your chief priest has delivered you over to me. And then he's like, yeah, and so what'd you do, by the way? I mean, he already knows the formal charges. Right? But he knows that there's got to be something more. You know, like, no, really, what'd you do to make these people so mad? You must have done something beyond just making some silly theological claim, because they're delivering you over me to have you killed on a cross. So what'd you do? And so there's another irony here. As Carson helps us see it more clearly, he writes it this way. It is just possible that under Pilate's question, am I a Jew? John finds lurking deeper ironies. Pilate despises and distrusts the Jews, yet in the course of the narrative, and so, stop there for a minute. Pilate and these religious leaders, they couldn't be on further ends of the political and cultural spectrum, you know? And yet, we're about to see where they unite, okay? So, like, Pilate despises and distrusts the Jews. And the same could be said the other direction, okay? Yet in the course of the narrative, he's really forced to adopt their position. Insofar as the Jews here represent the world, Pilate joins them. So remember, like, the religious leaders out front, they don't just represent Jewish religious leaders. And it's not just a condemnation of Jewish people. It's like they represent the created world order in active rebellion against their creator. And if we needed more evidence of that, what does who's on the opposite end of the political, geographical, you know, religious spectrum, he joins them. Ultimately, he'll join them. But now Pilate is shown to be simply rehashing what they said to him, right? So he joins them. So Jesus knows how he must answer. He knows he needs to bring a major clarification to the concept of his kingship. So verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." Okay, so Jesus can't, as we said, he can't claim to be king in his response without first, like, spending time, purposefully investing some time here, clearly defining his kingship. I can't just throw around the word king, right? So the word king and kingdom during the first century had a sense of reign and kingship, not territory. And so Jesus wants to make it clear his interest is not in claiming any territory for himself. After all, everything belongs to him anyway. The Romans can try to claim this territory, even though by right it belongs to the Jews. But even that comes about only because God gave it over. And all of it belongs to him. All of it is his. And the kind of king he actually is also the kind of king that is king of everything, regardless of what anyone thinks about it. Right? So it's not of this world. And the proof of this is Peter jumps out with a dagger, probably in part because of this false impression. This is the moment that Jesus is going to marshal his forces against the Romans. Go back and listen a couple weeks ago. We talk about that. Yet Jesus does not back Peter's play. Why? Do you remember? Why does Peter say, like, Jesus say, "Peter, put the sword away. Remember my cup? The cup of the Father's wrath that I need to, it's a gospel remembrance." He pivots back to gospel remembrance. What are we reminded in this? The prologue, who Jesus is, the Word become flesh, coming into the world that would reject him, not of this world, not from this place. Verse 37, then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king, you are a king, so you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." And we already know in John, this truth is kind of twofold, right? Because on the one hand, it really does describe the world and the problem of the world. You know, like, so other times that John has referred to this, he's referred to the issue. Why does the world condemn Jesus? Why does Jesus say that the world condemns him? Because he has spoken truth related to the human condition. He's spoken truly related to the problem of sin, right? So Jesus testifying to the truth does have this component of testifying to our need of him and our sin and the problem at the center. It does include also his purpose, like the what of the gospel, what it is that he came to do at the cross. So Jesus declaring truth, it does have to do with him declaring his substitution on our behalf. But it's even more than that. For Jesus, the truth is more than just an intellectual reality. It's a personal declaration. It's who he is. He is the truth. I am, ego eimi. I am the way, the truth, and the life. When Jesus says he came to bear witness about the truth, he's talking about himself centrally. He's talking about who he is, his very identity. And that's why Pilate misses it, because he's ultimately part of the world that cannot see it. But yet Jesus comes to declare it. And not only so, but as we saw, what does his spirit come to do? His spirit is the spirit of truth, by whom and through whom and only because whom we now see. So all of us are in the same predicament as Pilate and the religious leaders, ultimately, apart from the grace of Christ. We are those who cannot see the truth. We are those who will respond. Verse 38, Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And what do we need? The Spirit of God to come and do what only the Spirit of God can, because of the work of Christ, open our eyes to the truth of who Jesus is, that we might know, that we might believe, that we might come to see that he stood in our place, that he bore our punishment, that we can have life in him through his work. Okay, John's an evangelist. You know, it's very clear as he writes his account that he's writing this evangelistically. We've talked about it a lot. We'll talk about it again in a couple weeks, right, where the purpose of the book, and we'll re-examine it again, the same text that we preached through at the very first Sunday in John, we're going to preach through again in one of the last Sundays in John, kind of looking back at it. John says he wrote this that you might believe. He's writing this to spiritually seeking Jewish and Greek people in the temple, God-fearing Greeks, Jewish people who are wrestling with, is Jesus the Messiah of God? You know, like, who is the Messiah? Who is this Christ? And John comes along to say, Jesus is the Christ. What's John doing? He's bearing witness to the truth. Through the Spirit's work, he's doing what Jesus came to do, right? Continuing on this declaration, this proclamation of truth, and this is why we planted a church. That's why we planted Gospel Life. You know? To bear witness to the reality that Jesus died the death we should have died. That he lived the life we should have lived, that we failed to live, that he died the death we should have died. In our place, as our substitute, that we might be reconciled to him. We planted a church to make that known to those who are lost. It's why we did that. It's why we support church planting efforts. It's why we sent Northside Neighborhood Church to North Minneapolis. Continue to pray for them as they testify to the truth of who Jesus is and what he came to do. It's why we support church planting efforts like Kostelí Knock in the Czech Republic, Vášek Andrš's ministry there that's also planting more churches. Why? Guys, there's 630,000 people who live in Olomouc County, Czech Republic, and there's 10 small churches that reside there. So Vášek planted an 11th and the team at Kostel to bear witness to the truth that will hopefully plant a 12th and a 13th and a 14th, and we'll see exponential growth of Christians and believers in that region. There's a county known as Brno, 380,000 in Czech, 380,000 people in Brno with about 100,000 people in the university district on top of that, maybe six Christian churches. Very small, right? What's needed? Gospel work, church planting. So what's Vášek doing? Raising up leaders to send, right? For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. The Spirit of God is doing this work in the world of awakening people's hearts to the gospel. And in that we rejoice, and in that we desire to be used by God in that effort and work. And so Pilate, though, he cannot see it. He says, what is truth? A denial of Jesus is a denial of the truth, because it's by nature who he is. A denial of the truth is a denial of Jesus. And we live in a culture now in which this is the rallying cry. What is truth? This is the rallying cry of Western culture. On all sides of the spectrum, in terms of the political leanings, religious beliefs, we find a commitment to narrative over truth. Truth sometimes interferes with my narrative, and I don't really want to hear what's true. And we're often willing to, you know, we are all relativists. We're all becoming relativists in our culture, willing to bend the truth to fit our narratives. Our narratives at the center of our relativism. When in actuality, Jesus stands there as the truth, which, if embraced, is not beholden to any narrative, but instead challenges and even forces each narrative to come into line with who he is and what he's done, what he's come to do. How is this possible? After he said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, Pilate told them, I find no guilt in him. This is how it's possible. An innocent man, look, but you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So who do you want me to release to you? Or do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? They cried out again, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. So okay, this is the who of Holy Week, you know, like the who of the Passion, the one who had to come, the only one who could have done it. Like, it wasn't Barabbas for Jesus. It wasn't the guilty for the innocent. Though that's how we tend to think, and certainly that's what Pilate is trying to do. To be able to get out from under this. Surely they'll take the guilty man crucified, and they won't see Jesus as being the one who needs to go to the cross. He tries to squeeze out of it in this way. But it wasn't Barabbas for Jesus. It was Jesus. It wasn't Guilty Barabbas, clearly guilty, the one who nobody disputed his guilt, none of them. It was Jesus, innocent Jesus, for guilty Barabbas, and again, nobody really disputes the innocence of Jesus either. It was innocent Jesus for guilty Barabbas, guilty the rest of us. While Pilate attempts to give up Barabbas to the cross, the one who, on his view, deserved the Roman cross as a murdering zealot, as a robber, so that Jesus could be set free, Jesus goes to the cross so that Barabbas and the rest of us who deserve judgment could go free and have life. This is the reason we reflect on Holy Week, not just during Holy Week, but every Sunday we gather, because in it we have the news. It's the only news by which we can be saved. It's the only news that's available to us, that creates the kind of inward joy in life that cascades out into a new kind of living, a kingdom that is not of this world, in which we're the subjects of a kingdom that can't be shaken. The reality that his kingdom is not of this world is the very thing that makes this so transforming to the world. It can't be shaken. It can't be taken from us. And this is also why we're in the weekly habit of coming to the table, in which we declare the kind of king we serve, one whose body was broken and whose blood was shed for us. And so this morning, I want to invite you, if you're not a believer, and you're here with us this morning, and you're trying to make sense of Jesus, you're trying to make sense of, like, why is it the Christians, and we'll talk about this on Good Friday, you know, we come in and there's a big cross here, and there's this giant stained glass cross behind me, or behind you, in front of me. So we're both looking at a cross, and we're in this room. I'm not sure if you noticed this, but this is the case, especially older churches. Historically, it's shaped like a cross, this aisle way down the center that parts here, right? Like this symbol of a cross stands at the center of our liturgies. It stands at the center of our prayer historically. It stands at the center of our confessions because it stands at the very center of the revealed gospel to us. And so if you're here and you're like, why is the cross so central? It's because it's what we all deserved that Jesus took upon himself, that, listen, he made this way so that you can have resurrected life with him if you would just throw yourself upon his mercy. So I invite you to do that this morning. And then come, and here we have this meal, which is a representation, it's a remembrance of the reality of what he's done. His body was broken for us at the cross. His blood was shed. He's in union with us by faith. He goes with us. Like, he's a living God. So you can come and proclaim that for the first time here this morning. But if you're here and you're not sure, just this meal is a meal for believers. Walk with us, observe, don't touch. But I invite you forward now to come and do that.